Welcome to Outspoken, where we dive deep into the topics and intersection of technology, money, business, and passion. I'm your host, Shayna Cosgrove.
The real issue with digital literacy is there is no greater barrier to economic mobility than the inability to compete in a digital world. If the objective is to help people become economically mobile and pull themselves out of poverty, they must know how to do life in a digital world. Right now, today, there are still 7,200 kids in Baltimore City Public Schools who don't have the tech to engage online learning in the most constructive way. They're doing things like going to the library or trying to share with a friend, which puts them at an academically competitive disadvantage. Regardless of where you are, whatever setting you're in, whether you're in the military, whether you're in a job that you hate, whatever it is, you can pour into the people that you come in contact with. Regardless of what kind of role that you're in, you can lead, you can help, you can engage. I just was raised to engage in a more one-on-one, direct, and intimate way.
Well, today I am here with Baltimore's own Gary Bonner, who is the executive director of the Maryland PCs for People. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I remember specifically, you are Baltimore born and bred?
I am. I grew up in Baltimore, went to Northwestern High School, left in 1983 to go to undergrad, and came back 30 years later.
So you grew up in Baltimore City?
I grew up in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. Actually, in Pikesville, Mount Washington area.
Oh, nice. Right near where I live, pretty close to it. Yeah. And where did you go to undergrad?
University of Texas at Austin.
Whoa. So tell us about that transition. How that's pretty unusual, right?
It is. I went to school on an Air Force ROTC scholarship.
So that's
what took me down there. And it was quite an experience.
What did you major in down there?
Economics.
Did you have culture shock being in Texas?
I did. So, you know, you have this kid who comes from Northwestern, which is at that time, you know, one of the tougher schools in Baltimore, an urbanite, and I wind up in Texas. Now, Austin is a bastion of progressive thought in the vast ocean of conservative worldview, but it's still Texas. So, yes, it was quite a culture shock.
So how did you, as a high school student, decide that you wanted to be in the Air Force? Was that even common in your peer group or of your family?
You know, my dad was in the military. He was not a career guy, but he was in the military. And
which branch?
Army.
Okay, so you had to do different than he did.
But I was in junior ROTC in high school. I was actually our corps commander at Northwestern's Junior Air Force ROTC program.
Were there any women? Was it all men?
No, there were women. At least half our corps was women.
How big was it?
We had the largest detachment in the country, so we were 590 students.
Oh my goodness. And you were in charge of 590?
Mm-hmm. We had an entire floor of the school.
Did that influence your major at Texas?
It did.
How did you decide on economics?
Economics is the study of the psychology of how people participate in the marketplace. I've always been interested in understanding why we do what we do. Why do we human beings behave the way that we behave? And so that was always intriguing to me. My military occupation was intelligence. And so I knew I always wanted to be in that field. And so econ was really interesting to me. And then the other part of it was, you know, keep in mind, I think I changed my major like four times. And then I had this conversation with my dad who said, you know what? It's 4 years and I'm getting ready to write my last check. So you find something that you enjoy that you can walk across the stage with because there ain't no more money coming.
So my father had an 8-semester only policy.
Yep.
So your father did as well.
He did. And I do with my sons. And fortunately, the first one has met that. And the second guy is just a sophomore. So he's got a few more years.
Tell us a little bit about your military career. How long were you in?
I did my 4 years and promptly went back into the private sector. But I will say this, it was defining. There were definitely kind of a character defining, worldview defining experience. I often think sometimes, what would have happened? Where would I be if I had stayed and gone career? Because that was actually fully my intention. But during the time I was there, I really began to feel my heartstrings tugging me more towards an occupation that allows me to help people on a much, much larger scale, particularly people who were like the kids that I went to school with. Northwestern, when I was in school, was an underachieving school. It was a school that didn't have many kids who were above the poverty level. And that experience really shaped my view about, why are we here? Is it okay that some people do well and other people don't by sheer accident of birth?
Right.
You know, why can't we have a world where the strong bear with the infirmities of the weak and we work together to intentionally make room for one another as we build our communities? And that kind of stuff doesn't play well in the military when you're, you know, the objective is to kill the guy. I realized this evolving worldview that I have with a sense of calling is not compatible with the role that you're in.
What did you do to satisfy that urge or question while you were in the military? Because also at this time, you're a young man, and whether you were in the military or not, that's not necessarily a common feeling as well, right? Most people are worried about getting the house, getting out and getting married, and yet you feel this calling. How was it when, you know, you were in this culture, almost a military culture from high school on?
Yep.
What was it that continued to spur that feeling inside of you?
My worldview was really shaped by no small extent by my parents. So my mom is a retired Baltimore City public school teacher. My dad worked in the private sector at the Kennecott Corporation and was part of their management executive team. When we would come home from school, my sisters and I, my dad would always ask us two things. He would say, hey, are you smarter today than you are yesterday? And did you help anybody? And he actually, that was not a rhetorical question for him. You had to have an answer. He was that kind of person where he was father to all, like all of my friends, you know, the strays that we used to bring home with us. He was dad to all. And then my mom, I love to tell the story about my mom because it helps understand how she influenced me. But I'll never forget the time I was in the first grade and my parents had sent us to bed and I was just getting ready to get under the covers. And my mother comes in a huff. At that time, she was teaching at Cherry Hill Elementary. And she comes in a huff and she goes, oh, put your pants on real quick. I need you to come with me. And she takes me up to this store. We go in, she starts taking these clothes and having me try them on, fitting them next to me. And so she buys this stuff, I mean, a ton of it. And we get back in the car and finally I go, Ma, why are you buying me school clothes? I already have school clothes. And she goes, oh no, they're not for you. They're for this kid down at the school who's about your size. And I go, well, why are you buying him school clothes? And she goes, because we can. Now put your seatbelt on.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with me as a seven-year-old. You know, that was kind of how they did business. Regardless of where you are, whatever setting you're in, whether you're in the military, whether you're in a job that you hate, whatever it is, you can pour into the people that you come in contact with, regardless of what kind of role that you're in. You can lead, you can help, you can engage. I just was raised to engage in a more one-on-one, direct and intimate way.
Was your family the kind of family where everyone was welcome and your mom was always feeding extra kids every night?
Yep. Our house was the playhouse. And so our house was always the place where you could come and get food and you could hang out and you could have somebody to talk to who was real. And so my dad died in 2015, which is what brought me back to Baltimore. And I remember at his funeral, it was packed with all of these people who were kids that we grew up with, who I had no idea that he had that kind of impact on them. And they were all saying, oh yeah, he was like my dad. And that's kind of, you know, kind of how they were.
Wow, that's really nice. Did you have siblings too?
Yep. So I am the only boy. So I have one older sister, one younger sister. So like I'm the only boy and I'm in the middle. I got like the double psychological.
Did your sisters also do this ROTC program?
Not a chance. My youngest sister is a lawyer here in Baltimore. She does corporate transactions. And then my older sister is a financial services executive. She was a VP of insurance services for what was then Ferris Baker Watts. I think they have been bought or merged or something like that. that was her career, and she's retired now.
Tell us all about PCs for People.
So PCs for People is an amazing social enterprise. We focus on closing the digital divide, but more than that, our objective is to help people who are low wealth get access to good, affordable technology that is on par with where the marketplace is, but at price points that are attainable for them. We work with large corporations, middle-sized corporations, small businesses, people like you who have a great heart, and they bring us their retired tech. And to my right is a 10,000 square foot factory, if you will, where our team disassembles those electronic products and refashions those parts into PCs, laptops, computers, tablets that are usable for people today. And then we make them available. So you have to be 200% of poverty or below in order to secure a device from us. Imagine being able to walk in and get a laptop for, you know, $30 or right. $50, a PC for $25. The reason that we don't give them away is because part of our model is to help people who have been isolated and not part of the tech culture engage the market, put some skin in the game, and understand how to navigate it. So with each device comes digital literacy training and orientation. And so the objective is to equip each person with the ability to use tech to pull themselves forward into the lives that they want economically.
How long is the actual orientation?
The actual digital orientation is a 2-hour orientation. The objective is to make sure that you understand how to use it, to do practical things like get onto your online banking, apply for a job, decide that you're not going to use the check cashing places anymore. You're actually going to open a bank account. We'll do it electronically to pull you into kind of the mainstream of the economy.
Do you provide tablets and mobile phones as well?
We do not provide mobile phones at this point. Everybody has a phone. Where people struggle is, how do I understand how to operate in the marketplace? Like when I get a job, even if I've got a job in fast food, I've got to know how to use a computer.
Yeah.
And I've got to understand kind of generally how technology works. If I'm working in a factory, I've got to understand how that screen there on that machine probably works. It's got to become intuitive. I've got to be able to think that way. This is the new part of being functionally literate.
What do people do for managing their resume? Do they use Microsoft Word? Can you kind of explain that? Because as I know it, it's Microsoft Word traditionally, and then you save it as a PDF. What are your people doing?
All the devices that you get from us are going to have Microsoft Office on it.
Okay. It's not 365?
Yes.
It is 365. And you guys pay for the subscription, or how does that work?
We have a really nice, cool, wonderful relationship with Microsoft.
Thank you, Microsoft.
We're actually one of 4 nonprofit Microsoft authorized refurbishers in the country. We generally place about 110,000 devices into the hands of people nationally each year. So we've developed a really good ongoing relationship with them. So we don't get the licenses for free, but we get them for really, really, really inexpensive prices. So your device is going to have Microsoft Office. It's going to have everything you need to get on the internet. You're going to have a 1-year warranty, and you're going to have lifetime tech support. So at any point, there's an 800 number you call. It takes you into our tech support hotline.
What are the hours?
24/7.
No way. That's amazing. You have a 24/7 hotline.
Yes.
That must be lit up all the time, man.
It is. It is. I actually had a...
I can imagine, like, could you try rebooting it? Or my sister never understood, she's going to kill me. She never understood like the difference between her web browser and an internet connection. I had to explain that to her, that just because you had your web browser open didn't mean you were connected to the internet. So exactly. I'm guessing all of these things.
And I'm sure that she's fine with you sharing that.
Well, she doesn't listen. That's the price she pays for not listening. Now, do you guys remote in? Does the help desk remote in?
You have the ability to remote in.
Wow.
But our objective is to walk you through.
Right. You're teaching the people to fish for themselves. Correct. So that they can really learn from this. Every machine comes with Microsoft. Now, how do they connect to the internet?
So they either have an internet connection or we provide them with a mobile internet device. We have a relationship with T-Mobile Sprint where we can provide them with a device that will get them on the internet with somewhere between a 22 to a 40 megabytes per second connection. Enough to stream video, play games, do those kinds of things. Yes.
Do you teach people how to connect to their phone and use their phones as hotspots too?
We do. Mm-hmm. That's part of the digital literacy training. So you will know if you have a cell phone how to do that.
What do you do with the Apple machines that you get? Can you even refurbish them? Tell me about Apple.
Yep. So we do have a significant number of Apple devices in inventory. We do clean them up. We do refurbish them. We do make them available. A lot of our Apple devices, though, go to other nonprofit organizations. In addition to providing tech to individuals, we also provide tech and tech services to other organizations that are working in the cause of good. Other nonprofits, a couple of B corporations, public benefit corporations, we partner with as well.
How great. Why is it that the Apple gets given out? Because it's less common? So do you provide help desk for Apple as well?
We do. We provide help desk for everything that we provide, but we don't get as many Apple devices in, frankly, as we do, you know, Windows-based devices. Maybe 3% of the devices we get in the door are Apple devices.
Oh, only 3%?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, do you get headphones too?
Yep.
Any good Beats come in?
Yeah. So let me explain the other side, the social enterprise part, so that you can understand what we do get in.
Okay.
The reason that we can provide folks with computers for free or computers for next to nothing, you know, with low-cost computers is because large corporations like Whiting Turner just provided us with 600 i7 and i5 laptop computers, which run you about between $1,200 and $1,500. Most large corporations will keep those computers for 3 to 5 years and fully depreciate them. Doesn't mean they don't work. It just means that they are fully depreciated, so they bring in new assets because they get to deduct that depreciation.
Okay.
So they will donate them to organizations like ours if they're good. If they're evil, they don't. They sell them. So when you come in, most people are going to get what's called a PC or a laptop bundle. So that means if you're getting a desktop device, you're going to get the computer, the monitor, a webcam, a set of speakers. If it doesn't have built-in Wi-Fi, you'll have a Wi-Fi adapter that plugs into the side of the machine. Of course, you'll have a mouse, and you'll have everything that you need to be able to set up and get going. All of that material comes from donated material. And the cool thing about working with corporations is that they tend to buy really good high-end stuff.
Sure.
So when they retire it, it's pretty cool.
And that's all in like the $30 or $50 fee?
Yeah.
The whole bundle?
That's within the bundle.
Tell us about the people who work in the warehouse and work on taking, receiving, and refurbishing these PCs.
The most amazing people in the world. We have folks who have committed their lives to really being able to close it. Digital divide, highly educated. Matthew Levis is our lead tech here. He's an amazing human being. He has committed himself to providing good tech for people. And he has with him a couple of other computer techs, and they literally can do almost anything. Then we also have volunteers. So we have other volunteers who also come in and work with us and actually doing the refurb process. We've got folks who come in from Lockheed Martin and some of the other defense contractors. They always have really cool tech people who are looking for something to do. And if you know any cool people who are tech people who are looking for something to do, that's how we get it done. We have different lines for different things. So there's one line that is just diagnosing PCs and determining what's wrong. Another line that is doing what the guys with the techs call Frankensteining, which is I've got three devices which do something. Maybe one of them has a monitor that works. The other one has a hard drive that works. The other one has a power source that works. I'm going to take it out. I'm going to take all these parts out and combine them in one device that works really well. And then, of course, we have a deconstruction line. So if a device comes in and it doesn't fit our requirements for refurbishing, because we won't put anything on the market that is more than 5 to 7 years old. So Those devices, we will pull them apart. We will keep whatever, RAM, hard drives, things of that sort. And then we break them down to their commodity, plastic with plastic, metal with metal, precious metals that are inside of the, on the circuit boards. We separate those off. And then we actually have relationships with other R2 recyclers who pay us money for the weight to get that out of the environment. Nothing that we work on winds up in a landfill. And that's also the case with our partner recyclers.
Do you have anyone working who works 40 hours a week for you in the warehouse that came on with no experience and you had to train them?
Yes, we have 3 people right now. I have a total staff of 7 right now. But we will eventually have a staff of 17 by the end of 2021. We bring people in from the community who have no experience at all. Thinking of Darian, our warehouse tech, who came in, who had no experience. But we will teach you, we'll train you. All you have to do is have a passion for tech and people.
Where do you advertise your job?
Indeed.com is where we've gotten most of the folks. We've also had a couple of partnerships with organizations that, Baltimore Robotics Lab, we stole Matthew from them, and also Kyle. Empower also provides us with access to their candidates as well.
That's great. So you're hiring 10 more people this year?
We are. We're going to be hiring 10 more people.
All right, and go look for the jobs on Indeed. What safety concerns do you have working in the warehouse? Just generally because you're working with these significant metals and magnets and plastic, and then now you're also working during COVID.
Fortunately, we've had no COVID issues. All of our staff work in the warehouse. They are masked at all times, gloves at all times. If you were to make a visit to our office before you come in the front door, we shoot you in the head with a thing that finds out whether you've got a fever. Staff undergoes the same screen when they come in. And also our manufacturing process is designed to allow for social distancing. So there's actually 12 feet of space between each person working at their duty station in the warehouse.
Specifically related to just working with computers overall, are there concerns about that as well?
There are. So when you're working with computers, especially when you're deconstructing a computer, you're going to have dust. The internal elements of the board can also become aerosol. So there's a huge table that we have where we do deconstructing. It's got like these holes in it. This machine is awesome. And as you're working on it, it's literally sucking down everything that comes out of that device. So nothing goes up and it puts it in a tank. And then once a week, we have that tank picked up. The reason that we do it that way is so that you're not inhaling. You can't inhale metal. You can't inhale those things that are bad for you. But the other thing is that because we are a NAID certified facility, which is a national quality and safety standard, we're audited once a year. And what they're looking at will be our safety processes, our quality processes, and our security process.
Yeah, it's pretty significant.
Yeah.
Explain to us how you came to start PCs for People in Maryland in the start of a global pandemic. How did that all come about?
At the time, I was working as chief operating officer of Azure Healthcare Services in Washington, D.C. And I was happy as a lark. And Jane from the Deutsch Foundation, who's the CEO of the Deutsch Foundation, who has been involved in digital literacy issues for years, really wanted to find a way to bring an organization that would be focused on closing the digital divide to Baltimore. So she reached out to PCs for People in Minnesota and said, hey, can you guys come to Baltimore? And they're like, well, we don't really do that.
So they were a one location organization.
One location organization.
She wanted a franchise.
Yeah.
When did she ask this? Prior to the pandemic?
2019. Just as we're about to come online, the pandemic hits. And so they reached back to me and says, all right, Gary, what do you want to do? Do you want to wait it out? And I was like, nope. I got on a plane, which was incredibly dangerous at that time, flew to Minnesota, spent a week up there observing their processes, came back, got a warehouse from Merrick Properties with literally nothing in it, and then started calling around to see who could donate furniture and who could give us, kind of our startup package. The Deutsch Foundation gave us $150,000, and that's really how we got our start.
How were you involved when you had this great, happy job in healthcare? How did that even happen? And what was the impetus to say, like, I'm going to give up my healthcare job and run a nonprofit?
Yep. A friend of mine called and said, hey, I just saw this advertisement for an executive director for this organization that does exactly what you've always talked about. And so we had this conversation. And when I looked at it and realized that this was a nonprofit, but it's a social enterprise nonprofit, I immediately knew that's exactly where I wanted to be. You know, I'd spent all my career in corporate, and I understood that it is possible to compete in the marketplace and do good with the fruits of the labor that you get from competing in the marketplace. And that's really our model.
Is that the definition of what a social enterprise nonprofit means? I don't know the terms that well. Can you explain the difference between a standard nonprofit and a social enterprise?
So social enterprise uses the marketplace in order to solve a problem. And one of the reasons that I didn't want to go the normal traditional nonprofit is that a traditional nonprofit exists and it's got to keep existing. It doesn't really like take territory and hold it. It doesn't solve the problem. Versus a social enterprise that harnesses technology and market know-how, my objective is to drive the level of, right now there are 75,000 households in Baltimore that don't have a computer or high-speed internet. 22% of our city lives in poverty. 42% of our city earns below the living wage, which is $17.20 an hour. So my objective is 2 years from now, I want that 75,000 number to be zero. When that number is zero, then we will begin to focus our efforts in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia and other markets to do the same thing.
What percentage of those 75,000 have children in the Baltimore City schools that also had to learn from home, even though they weren't provided devices or internet by their school as well?
Yep, more than half. In fact, the first thing I had to do when I got on the ground was figure out how to get 1,200 computers into the hands of kids who are in Baltimore City Public Schools. And even through that initiative, right now, today, there are still 7,200 kids in Baltimore City Public Schools who don't have the tech to engage online learning in the most constructive way. They're doing things like going to the library or trying to share with a friend, which puts them at an academically competitive disadvantage.
I think the pandemic really highlighted not only that so many people are behind digitally, but the digital divide became even greater for the students who are all supposed to be learning from home. And yet, because school funding is not equitable either,
right,
these schools also don't have resources to provide internet and or laptops to these students as well. And so they're sitting at home, supposedly supposed to do distance learning, and they cannot do it.
Right.
Unless I guess they have piles of paper.
Right. What I worry about, though, is the pandemic made digital literacy, it kind of put it on people's radar for the first time. But the other thing that it did unwittingly is, it's sexy to help little kids get computers to be able to do their work online. I could put the little kid in front of you and you'd be like, okay, Gary, what do you need? The real issue with digital literacy is there is no greater barrier to economic mobility than the inability to compete in a digital world. If the objective is to help people become economically mobile and pull themselves out of poverty, they must know how to do life in a digital world, not just for the job purposes, but even for education, for learning, to be able to access what I call the democratized world of information that's available on the internet. So my worry is that as COVID begins to abate, then folks are like, okay, well, all the kids are back in school, they've got computers now, and we solve that problem. No. And so one of the things that we're working to do here is, as we have gotten support from great partners who have wanted to sew in financially to help kids get computers, we really also want them to understand, hey, it's more than that. It is making sure that child's parents can function in a digital world. A lot of folks don't realize people who are low wealth often live in isolation. They're isolated from those things that we take for granted. I take for granted that I can go look at my phone and see who's standing on my front porch and then tell my kid, okay, it's okay to unlock the door. Most people can't function that way and don't have a concept of it. it's important to understand that digital literacy and digital inclusion is an economic mobility barrier. It's solvable. It is so solvable. The reason that Andy and Casey, who are the two guys who founded our organization, founded it, Andy was a social worker, and he was working with a kid who was 14, and him and his wife had an old PC back in 1990 sitting in their garage, and they were like, okay, well, let's just give it to this kid. They were surprised that this kid who was headed towards reform school gets this thing and it transforms his life. And Andy goes, wow, I wonder what would happen if we did more of that.
When did the organization start?
1990.
What success stories have you seen so far locally?
The first success story that really warmed my heart was we had a lady, I'm not going to give her name, but she was an older lady who lived alone, didn't have any family. At that time, we weren't even open. I was still outfitting the warehouse. So she calls me on my cell phone and introduces herself, tells me her story. She's 80 years old and she lives in public housing. And she was trying to find a way to watch her church services because her church wasn't having service because of COVID. And she wanted to be able to watch. It was so important to her. And she goes, and I heard that I could maybe get a computer from you all. How much does it cost? And so I said, well, why don't you come down and let's talk about how we get you set up. So we get her in, we got her a computer, got her all the stuff that's set up. And I thought to myself, this lady is not going to be able to walk back into her house and set this thing up. So my two techs go out to her house and they wind up installing the PC, getting her desk to put it on, connecting it to the internet, checking in with her every couple of days to make sure that she's got it. And now she has God, she is like so cool, so jazzed. It opened up the whole world of how isolated senior citizens are and how having a computer can open things up for them as well.
Do you guys offer a series of classes as well?
We do not.
Not yet.
Not yet. I'm actually working with another nonprofit to develop a curriculum. One of our funders funded our ability to set up a virtual classroom so we could now provide synchronous and asynchronous online training. So now I'm in the process of vetting curriculum and we'll stand that capability up, but I don't expect to have it running until March.
Yeah, I know that is just so critical. I mean, even just understanding how to use Microsoft Word or Excel is so critical for so many office jobs, even jobs, as you said, don't typically rely on technology such as serving food, but you still are working with this high-tech cashier program and they're probably recording all this data on you.
Yes,
and seeing your performance and talking into your headset. So there's a comfort there. And then office jobs or so many office jobs require email and an ability to understand how to use Microsoft Word and how to use Excel. Are you setting up people's emails too? Are you helping people walk through email?
We will help you set your email up. What we're looking to develop is more of a, what I call a comprehensive curriculum for digital literacy. And that's the mountain that I'm focused on climbing right now.
Well, it sounds like you're off to an amazing start. Now, I have a book club. I'm a big reader. Is there a book you've read in your life that really impacted you personally or professionally?
Yes. It's going to sound crazy, but if you are really interested in engaging the conversation about economic mobility, the book that had the biggest impact on me was, believe it or not, Capital.
By who?
Thomas Piketty. In this book, what he does is he takes a look at nationally and globally how economic mobility works. Who is able to become economically mobile and who isn't and why not. And he named his book Capital because he wanted to point out how cash flows through our economy, who it goes to, and how those people understand how to leverage it to build the lives that they want. His conclusion is we have to have a way of massively, on a huge scale, equipping people with what it takes to pull themselves forward economically. You'll never be able to charity your way out of it. You'll never be able to donate enough stuff to help people who are struggling. The emphasis has to be on education and acculturation or socialization.
Now, what's next
My big hairy goal in Baltimore is to address the whole internet thing. So yes, we have hotspots that we give people, but I'd love to see a social enterprise, namely mine, actually become a wireless internet service provider and be able to stand up our own towers and make internet access, high-speed internet access, available to people for very little money. We have a beta running in Columbus, Ohio right now that has already begun to operate and has subscribers, and we're watching that. And as we perfect that model, we're going to bring that model to Baltimore.
How long does it take to put up a tower?
A matter of weeks. Right now, we're negotiating with the National Fiber Exchange to be able to get direct access to fiber, the same access to say that AT&T has. Rather than trying to buy bandwidth from them, we want to go to the source that they get it from. Once you've got that set up, then you've got to go through the permitting process and the zoning process and all that stuff. You've got to have folks who agree, organizations who agree to let you put a tower on their roof. You know, we're going through that process, and that means developing relationships with other organizations who say, hey, I'll let you put that on my roof. And then making sure that you have the ability to broadcast that coverage and have it be good. So our objective is that by 2022, we'll be able to service at least 10,000 people with unlimited broadband at least 100 megabits per second.
That's wonderful. Now, what does volunteering look like? Is it hours, repeated? What's the typical setup for being able to help volunteer?
We have volunteer occupations. So there are volunteers who want to work actually in the plant, engaging the refurbishing process. And so if that's something you're interested in, we will sign you up for training, and then we will put you on a schedule.
Is there an age limit?
Yes, you have to be at least 18. So yes, you do have to be an adult to work in the plant. Now, where young people come into play is that you don't have to be an adult to work with us to help provide digital literacy training and coaching to people. We're actually in the process of recruiting what we call digital navigators. A digital navigator is a person who comes alongside another person and helps them navigate, essentially getting access to the digital world. They're the person who sits with you and says, all right, now you've got your computer. Let's talk about where you're getting your internet. Okay, now you've got those two. Now, let's talk about how to make sure it goes and stays going and you can accomplish the things that you want. And they kind of work with you to determine how to do that.
And how young can you be to do that?
16.
What's the major piece of advice you give to people who are just getting their first PC or becoming digitally literate?
The first piece of advice I give them is you can't break it. It won't break. You can try all kinds of stuff. You can get stuck. You can start again. Don't treat it like it's a teacup. It's not. That device is durable. Then the next thing that I say to people is use your imagination as you begin to look at how you can leverage this. You have a voice. You have a story you want to tell. Do you want to blog? Do you want to compose music? You know, these are all things that you can do through your device. And don't look at it as something that you're just going to write letters on and do homework on. You don't have to be Bill Gates. You know, you don't have to turn yourself into a techie. Just have fun.
Now, last question for you. Tell me something about yourself that would surprise us.
Here's one that nobody ever guesses. I actually commanded the ROTC Honor Guard at Ronald Reagan's inaugural ball in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
I was 16. That was impactful for a 16-year-old kid from Baltimore.
I can imagine. Wow. Tell us how we can reach you.
You can reach us by dialing 443-396-PC4P or 7247.
Say it one more time.
443-396-7247.
Okay. Give a call.
Give us a call. And we are located at 2901 East Biddle Street. And so stop by as well and ask for a tour and just chew the fat with us. We'd love to talk to you.
Are you good about email? What's your email?
My email is G as in Gary Bonner, B-O-N-N-E-R at PCsForPeople.org. So that's PCsForPeople.org.
And we'll be sure to have all of this information and more in the show notes so that everyone can follow up for volunteering, donating, or getting their own device. what you're doing is really helping change lives. And the more you can get people gathered around the story to help keep this enterprise going, the more we can do good. So we can all do our little part each day to help improve the lives of others. And thank you for taking such a big role in your life in helping others' lives. And kudos to you for all that you have accomplished so far. Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please be sure to share it with friends and family. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under the Outspoken Podcast. Thanks again, and chin up, heads up, eyes forward.